Welcome to Locked On Heat. On today's show, we'll revisit Ray Allen's famous shot in Game 6 of the 2013 NBA Finals before being joined by a very special guest.
That's right. ESPN's Doris Burke will be joining us to talk about the NBA Finals, Golden State's dominance, LeBron's free agency, and more. Thank you so much for listening and for subscribing. Let's get to the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm a credentialed writer covering the NBA for the Step Back, and I write for the Miami Heat's Tip Off magazine. You can find me on Twitter at WC Goldberg.
And I'm David Ramil, a credentialed NBA writer who's covered the Heat and League at large for SB Nation and Fansided. And you can follow me and my writing on Twitter at DRamil13.
Today is a special show for two reasons. One, today is the anniversary of Ray Allen's shot in Game 6 of the NBA of the 2013 NBA Finals, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And two, in just a few minutes, we'll be joined by the one and only Doris Burke, who has been a huge supporter of the Locked On Podcast Network, and we're beyond excited to have her on the show. But David, let's start with Ray Allen. Today is the fifth anniversary of the most important shot in Miami Heat history, right? I don't think there's any doubt about that. But do you think that that was the most important shot in NBA history?
That's a tough question to answer, obviously. There was so much riding on that one particular shot, but there is, I suppose, a little bit of recency bias, given that it's only been 5 years since that one shot. It's certainly become an iconic moment in NBA history. I don't know if it necessarily holds that supreme weight of being the most important shot, single shot.
What else is up there? Like, I'm thinking like Jordan's shot versus Utah, Kyrie's shot? Against the Warriors?
No, not even close. Jordan's shot, again, similarly iconic because it's iconic. Michael Jordan. You could make the case for individual plays, say, you know, Havlicek stole the ball, that kind of thing. But I don't know if there's any one shot that's really determined the course of any, not just one season, but and not even just one franchise. Maybe you're right then. It's the most important shot in NBA history. We've talked about this before. We've written about this before. That shot had a huge impact as far as where Miami would have continued to progress, what would have happened with the league. You know, in a piece I did, I think last year, kind of broke that down, that if Ray Allen doesn't hit that shot, there's a very good chance that Miami breaks up the roster because they still want to make the most of LeBron's impact while he's on that team. You trade away Chris Bosh. Whatever reason, the small ball doesn't seem to work, you blow it up. Maybe you try to acquire another superstar. Maybe a guy like Carmelo Anthony or somebody else. Maybe try to bring him to join LeBron. Maybe Chris Paul or somebody along those lines. Have him come with Dwayne Wade and LeBron James in Miami. But then without the 2013 finals, and remember, a lot of people tend to gloss over the fact that it wasn't the shot that won anything for Miami. It simply tied the game so that Miami right. could go on into overtime and not only win that overtime, but then have to win Game 7 at home against the Spurs.
But that shot, people forget it tied the game. It didn't win the game, like you said, but it kind of did win the game, right? Because after Ray Allen hits that, the Spurs aren't winning that game. I felt like
they were still close. They were still in it.
No, it was a good overtime, but I also felt like afterwards I was like, oh, the Heat are winning this game. And I am probably...
Momentum certainly shifted.
And I'm like one of the most, like... I could jinx a team like with my eyes closed. Doesn't matter. I am one of the most anxious, nervous fans that are out there. But I thought that for sure the Heat were winning that game. It reminded me like the opposite of the J.R. Smith debacle in Game 1 of these last finals where, you know... The Cavaliers had as much right to win that game, probably more of a right to win that game than the Warriors did. But after J.R. Smith's blunder, it was just like, well, there's no way the Cavaliers bounce back from that. It felt like that because at the end of that game, remember Kawhi missed those free throws. Tim Duncan missed a bunny at the rim. It was just like everything was going wrong for the Spurs. But what you were talking about how that shot in and of itself changed the course for not only Heat's franchise, and you wrote about this. It changed the course for the Spurs franchise, too, because they come back that next year, hungrier than ever, ready to just wanting nothing more than to seek revenge and get those, and they had an edge to them, where they ended up just dominating the 2014 NBA Finals over those same Miami Heat, that same Miami Heat team. And that dominance kind of forced LeBron's hand to make a change in his own career, and he goes to Cleveland to team up with a younger Kyrie Irving and a younger Kevin Love. I mean, the way that shot... just had that ripple effect over so much of the league. And then
that's the thing that really stands out to me then is also the impact across the league is that The Spurs in 2014 played a completely different style where they move the ball, this kind of pass-friendly offense that we saw inspire later incarnations, notably the 60-win Atlanta Hawks team that kind of dominated a couple years later when Mike Budenholzer, you know, a Spurs assistant, kind of led that team. And then it kind of the incarnation of the Golden State Warriors that are dynastic and as strong as they've been, you know, a team that can rely on ISO-heavy basketball when they want to, but still swings the ball, looks for that best shot, creates good opportunities. And that, of course, you know, small ball offenses. You could say that, you know, Eric Spoelstra and Chris Bosh changed the course of the league by implementing a small ball lineup. But, you know, Golden State really took it to another level with Draymond Green, et cetera. So none of that happens, I think, without that one shot forcing the San Antonio Spurs to evolve, which forced the league to evolve as a result.
And then LeBron, of course, going back and forth, right? Leaving Cleveland to Miami, Miami back to Cleveland. I mean, just the way that he was able to be so nimble, so to speak, and just kind of take his career into his own hands. Yeah. I mean, people always talk about Kevin Durant's decision and how that was sort of the follow-up on LeBron's 2010 decision. But if LeBron had decided to stay in Miami, that just sort of becomes his new home. I don't know that that really does make as much of a difference to a guy like Durant and makes that sort of path easier for a guy of Durant's caliber to just switch teams, right? I think it's for LeBron to just kind of decide when he wants to go back and forth, to leave a team on the heels of a championship appearance, on four championship NBA Finals appearances, to go back to Cleveland. It made his decision his own. And I think that made it a lot easier for Durant than just the singular decision in 2010. The two decisions in 2010 and 2014 made it very easy for Durant to decide to go to the Warriors and create that dynasty there that you were just talking about. So, I mean, the shot, again, 5 years after the fact, I think we're going to still continue to see things, especially when it comes down to what happens maybe with Kawhi. I mean, this summer, I mean, Kawhi had a huge part to play in that 2013 Finals. If he doesn't, you know, I don't. What does it make a difference if he makes those free throws or if Ray Allen doesn't make the shot and they win that year, but then Kawhi doesn't come back the next year and win Finals MVP? Like, I wonder if that we could analyze that and a whole slew of other things. I mean, there's just so much that goes into that shot.
Absolutely. But let's move on, shall we, to our conversation with ESPN's Doris Burke. So stay tuned and listen to that conversation next.
Well, first of all, thanks for taking the time out of your day and jumping on the podcast with us, and congrats on the new contract. You seemed to be pretty open about it during negotiations. I know we speak for a lot of NBA fans that were excited and relieved to know that you'll be back in part of our NBA experience next season.
Oh, well, thank you. And yes, a lot was made of the fact that I said, you know, it's nerve-wracking sort of going contract to contract. I don't think there's a person in our business who doesn't feel similarly to me in that while you're waiting for that to sort of play itself out, it's a little unsettling. But yes, I am thrilled and can't wait for next season.
I was talking to my girlfriend this morning. She's really excited to listen to this afterwards because she, like a lot of people in the field, look up to you. And I wonder, you know, I'm sure you're aware that you're a role model for a lot of women in media. Do you feel an extra sense of responsibility to do a good job given your platform?
You know, I've always thought, I've been fortunate in my career to do some things that maybe I was the first woman just, and some of that, a lot of it actually has to do with timing, right? So there are so many women who came before me, like a Susan Waldman, Jackie McMullen, Gail Gardner, and they, you know, probably had to pay a price that I have not had to pay in terms of acceptance and those things. What I think about the future generation, frankly, is that they're going to go to places and advance to places, at least I hope, to spots that I haven't gone. And my only thought is they are talented and knowledgeable and passionate. And so, you know, they're on their way. What I do think about is I certainly don't want to make the path any harder. Like, I want to conduct myself in such a way that the next woman who comes along, hopefully her path is a little bit easier as mine was because of the women I had already mentioned. So that's kind of how I look at that.
As far as analysts go, I mean, you're in a unique situation where you can bounce from the sideline to the booth, and your analysis in and of itself kind of just stands out as just some of the smartest out there. And I wonder, you know, given your background playing and coaching and things like that, what is the most difficult part of not only preparation, but like during the game, during game days, and, you know, all the observations that you have to take in? And is there, what do you feel sort of gives you the edge there that allows you to just sort of stand out as one of the premier analysts that are involved in NBA coverage right now?
Well, first of all, I appreciate that you think I do a good job. As you know, we operate in a very subjective business. So you could walk into a room with two people conversing with opinions that are 180 degrees from one another, and they could be talking about the same announcer, right? Because, say, one person likes this, you know, person's style, and somebody else likes this person. You know, maybe somebody's more numbers driven, or somebody likes a little bit more flavor to the analysis. So it is sort of subjective. So I appreciate when someone enjoys what I do. You know, it's interesting. What's the hard part? Like, because I love the game, there's really, I don't know that there's necessarily a hard part to what I do. You know, we all prepare. The most important thing I do is watch games and then, you know, kind of review stats and then talk to coaches and players. And if you're lucky enough, go to practice. Believe it or not, I find the sideline job a little bit more challenging in this way. You are required in shorter stints to try to have an effect on the broadcast. And so you, because, you know, stylistically, when I'm a sideline reporter, one thing I don't like to do is talk over live action. I don't think the viewer at home, their experience is enhanced necessarily if a sideline reporter is sort of talking over multiple plays. If you talk over one or two, it's fine. But to me, to let that play-by-play document and the analyst sort of, you know, have their input as well, you've got to really be impactful in short windows. And so the reason that's more challenging to me is, what are the most important pieces of information I've collected in that role that I think can have an impact on the game? And so sometimes you might go into a game with 100 storylines, but the game plays a certain way, or maybe this player is out tonight and you have several ideas on that, you know, Kevin Durant, say, whatever the case may be. It's just the two jobs are fundamentally different. And it's an interesting situation for me to try to have an impact in both, in, you know, and you have to do it in drastically different ways.
Well, Doris, I can appreciate your modesty there, but I think I've never seen a media personality that is as universally beloved as you are. So I think I speak for a lot of NBA Twitter when they say that you are among the best of the best. And anyway, let's move on a little bit to the actual product on the floor. We just finished up the finals in a heck of a great NBA season. Golden State obviously has won their third title in 4 years. They look like a pretty dominant team, a dynastic team, if you will. What kind of team do you think could potentially beat them next season? Obviously, we're hearing a lot of scuttle about big-time free agent moves, but Golden State still seems like they're primed for another run at a title next year. What do you see as a potential team capable of knocking them off their perch?
Well, I think, you know, the first challenge they'll face is internally, right? Because I think we saw that this year in terms of every guy admitting to us in the course of our coverage of the finals saying the regular season was its own unique grind. And I think Steve Kerr actually said to me at the podium, this was by far the most challenging year. And, you know, I think you saw that Steve Kerr trying any number of different ways to pull on strings to reach the players. And so I think fundamentally there's some challenges internally in terms of making sure you're building the right habits. Mm-hmm. I think the other part of what maybe surprised me in our very first meeting at the NBA Finals before game one was Steph, KD, and Clay all admitting to us how much pressure and anxiety the Houston Rockets caused them. Like, you had the distinct sense in talking to them that they knew what a real threat Houston was, at least in that series. Now, whether they believe they're a long-term threat, I don't know. So I can't, and I won't, because I've seen too many times in the NBA how fragile success can be, and go in and say, they're definitively the favorite, because as you just mentioned, there is so much to play out in the offseason in terms of free agency. What happens with Kawhi? What happens with LeBron James? Because those two men, and there are a handful of these types of players in the league, where their movement can fundamentally shift the power structure of the NBA. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's fragile. It's funny because there was a point in the season where, you know, and I've had in the course of interacting with a couple of different coaches where basically a couple of different coaches, and then you saw this play out, mentioned, listen, how many great teams are there in the league right now? And essentially the thought among several coaches were, you know, there were two really tremendous teams, Houston and Golden State. And that below that was the rest of the league to varying degrees. And, you know, again, so much of what plays out is going to be contingent on the players and where the power structure changes because of those moves. So I'm curious. I don't think Golden State was without challenge this year, nor do I believe it will be without challenge next season.
Well, that kind of ties into a follow-up question, because obviously since Kevin Durant joined the team a couple of years ago, most fans, I think your most casual fans, are kind of turned off by the notion that it's going to be another Golden State repeat year after year. Do you think that type of dominance is quote-unquote bad for the NBA?
I don't. I just find that argument null and void because of the types of numbers that the viewership is generating. I mean, the NBA is very hot. I know ESPN and TNT, you look at the ratings they have done throughout the course of the regular season and the playoffs, and, you know, there's a lot to be said for the interest of the NBA. The other piece is you could look at a team like the Boston Celtics and the incredible run that they had in the playoffs, and the accelerated growth of guys like Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and Terry Rozier. And it happened because of some injuries to Kyrie and Gordon. But how much does that enhance their championship window a season from now? Because Kyrie had already had high-level NBA Finals experience. Gordon Hayward had that one longer run in Utah, not that it was especially long, but he has some playoff experience. And so I think that the Celtics, because of the market they're in and the year they had, will drive some interest. And I think their championship window, you know, is probably, you know, greater next year because of the growth of those young players. And we'll see what Danny Ainge does, because he has assets and talent and draft picks. And so is there a move to be made there? Is Kawhi somebody that's legitimate? I know that the Boston Celtics, or I've read that they've long coveted Anthony Davis. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know. In game one of the NBA Finals, the drumbeat was, oh, we're sick of this matchup. Right. And then LeBron James, until you had some very difficult officiating, and I'm not just talking about the overturned block charge, I'm talking about a couple of clean strips that went against them defensively, and then a non-call on LeBron, and then the Draymond Green, the two plays that were in that, you know, final five-minute report. The reality was the tone and tenor of that series would have looked drastically different if Cleveland had pulled off that upset. So, I don't know. I would say no. I guess I'm not buying into that argument.
We'll be back with more with Doris Burke after this quick break, but make sure you're subscribed to Locked On Heat on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, and remember to check out the rest of what the Locked On Podcast Network has to offer, including shows for your favorite NBA team. There's no better way to stay up to date with what's going on in the league. Doris Burke says some nice things about the network later on in this show, and if it's good enough for Doris, it's good enough for you. The Locked On Podcast Network, your team, every day. And to sort of add to that point, I mean, Golden State's dominance in general, I think, adds a little bit more intrigue into the offseason, those summer months. It turns the NBA almost into a 12-month-a-year sport, because now you have all these teams like the Rockets last summer sort of trying to gear up to try to beat the Warriors. It adds to a storyline and almost like a mission statement to the offseason. And I think there's a lot of that happening in these next few months. Obviously, you've been around LeBron a lot during these last few finals and over the years. What is your sense about how he's going to make his free agent decision this summer? Because that obviously is the biggest domino that needs to fall. And where do you think would be the best fit for him if he does want to find a team to challenge the Warriors?
Right. I was very intrigued. And then I saw Dwayne Wade's follow-up tweet basically saying, like, you know, I have no internal knowledge. I'm just thinking as he would think. But I did think it interesting that he said he would consider, you know, where his children are. And listen, I'm a parent of a 26 and a 24-year-old, and I would tell you that the idea of moving either of the two of them when they were teenagers would have been incredibly difficult for me at that moment, knowing the social dynamics for a young child. And for LeBron, whatever transpires from here moving forward, his legacy is secure. You know, the fact that it's no longer sacrilege to discuss Michael Jordan and LeBron in the same breath, to me, is a fundamental shift from even a year ago, right? Like, his 15th season seemed to tip the scale in a direction we hadn't to this point seen. And so I'm really curious. And we, you know, we will know by the choice he makes what is the most important thing to him, I think. You know, there are some intriguing possibilities. One thing that I did hear, and his choice will tell us a lot as it relates to this, I was told that LeBron wants to get off the ball more in the future, meaning he doesn't necessarily want to function full-time as that point forward. If that is in fact the case, then it opens the door to other things. For instance, if you're Philadelphia and you know LeBron wants the ball, then you might say, if I take the ball out of Ben Simmons' hands, that negates his ability to function. And do I want to do that in what is essentially his second year in the NBA? Because, I mean, listen, you're going to, in my mind, you would stunt his growth if you took the ball out before he develops a perimeter game.
Right.
However, if LeBron makes it clear, listen, I'm willing to get out and transition, take it off the window, push ahead to Ben, and sprint the passing lane, that's a different dynamic. So some of that all has to be fleshed out in the process for LeBron. But I'm curious. I will say this, guys. I feel privileged to have called the game at a time when one of the generational players in NBA history is playing. Like, what this man is achieving is truly special. It's really, and I would ask you that question. Where do you think a fit is for LeBron James?
I mean, going back to what you said, I mean, he talked a lot about the idea of playing with people with high basketball IQ. And I thought that was a really interesting thing, because I think us in the media, we talk about, okay, what would be like the best X's and O's fit for him? He needs shooters around him, etc. We talk about that, like the space that LeBron needs. But he talked about just guys that think the game at a level that he thinks the game. And I thought that was a really interesting thing, because you go back to his decision in 2010 about teaming up with a guy like Dwayne Wade and then Chris Bosh and under an organization with like Spoelstra and Pat Riley. Those are guys who think the game at that level. I thought that was a whole new way to sort of just try to decipher what LeBron is going to decide this summer.
And it's a great point, because I don't think, you know, this guy is so savvy that I think he has given thought, and he knows how much every word he says is parsed. And so I don't think that was purely accidental what he said. Mm. And here's an interesting thing I would love to get your perspective on too. Like, so he says the part about when he was talking about Golden State, he said they have the luxury of not having the pressure on a night-by-night basis. So you have the night where Steph makes the record number of threes in an NBA Finals game, and then he completely, the next game, just can't make a shot. And so one game it was Steph, the next it was Kevin Durant. And you could have kind of had a toss-up, in my estimation, for who the Finals MVP was.
Mm-hmm.
So he makes that point. And then I see Kevin Durant say, well, there is something special about functioning and distinguishing yourself amongst a group of great players. So I would put this question to both of you. Were those words from the respective parties there directed at each other, do you think? Or were they merely observational and tangentially you could say, okay, you know, I could apply that to either side?
That's difficult to answer. I'm not sure. I think, you know, part of it is the kind of, you have to demonstrate a mutual respect publicly. And I think a lot of what their responses are geared towards that. You have to be able to show that you respect your opponent and everything else along those lines. And it's kind of hard to kind of discern the true meaning behind those words. Kevin, in particular, is so difficult to pinpoint as far as what his responses ultimately mean, because he seems more than anybody else, and especially from Golden State, to kind of have a differing point of view that stands out amongst his teammates. It says a lot more about, I think that comment says a lot more about how Durant views himself on the Warriors roster rather than how he sees LeBron standing out in Cleveland. So I'm not sure that there's a clear answer there, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think both men are remarkably savvy. And I do think, you know, great players observe each other and certainly bring, you know, unique perspective to it. The league is fascinating in general. Yeah. And there's this, you know, give and take at the power structure of the league that I find fascinating as well.
Well, I know we've got to wrap up, so just one quick question, obviously, for our listeners about the Miami Heat, specifically about Eric Spoelstra. He's, obviously a well-respected coach from around the league, and you've covered him quite a bit over the years. How he stands out among the elite coaches in the league, is there anything about him that stands out personally to you? Because I think he's known throughout South Florida as being somewhat cliched, at least publicly, but I think he's obviously an intelligent coach and a very well-respected one, like I said. So is there anything that you see in your interactions with Spoelstra and the Heat that kind of stand out?
Yeah, you know, I would first make the point that going all the way back to a conversation with Stan Van Gundy, and this is this is a long time ago, where in a private setting, he basically was talking about what he believed was one of the best basketball minds he had been around. And so I remember being struck by the fact that Stan spoke so highly of Eric before he was a championship coach. Then I would tell you that the respect amongst his peers, which to me is the greatest compliment you could get, regardless of your profession. If others who are doing what you do think well of what you do, what higher compliment is there? Because they live the job. And so the fact that he has the respect that he does, and then just watch his teams, you know, the kind of effort the players give every night. You know, are you maximizing the talent? Are you getting the players, are you getting players shots in their most productive area? You know, is there a consistent defensive approach to what they're trying to take away? I mean, he just checks so many boxes from a basketball perspective. And then just on a very personal note, I have just always appreciated how willing he is to answer questions. If I don't understand something, I can ask him, and, you know, he doesn't make me feel silly for asking any question I might ask. I still have so much to learn. And then, you know, just his openness and willingness to share information, in particular, as I try to cover his teams, has always been greatly appreciated. And as someone who has to conduct those interviews sometimes in game, and sometimes at the most inopportune moments of the pressure of the playoffs. You know, a lot of coaches don't tell you anything. Sometimes they just do it in nicer fashion than the others. And I've always appreciated that he is, he's kind even in the most intense of moments.
He certainly does a good job of being able to say a lot of things in like press conferences and stuff without giving away too much. But he does seem pretty affable when it comes to the media. But look, Doris, thanks for taking the time out of your vacation and jumping on with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
And thank you for your support of the Locked On Podcast Network. We really do appreciate it. We look forward to watching you next season. This was fun. Thanks, Doris.
I'm telling the truth. Anybody who's covering the NBA and doesn't listen to the Locked On Network is crazy. To me, it's one of the best sources of information. Other than the beat writers digging in every day, the Locked On Network, I consider it must listen. So my pleasure.
That's very kind. Take care, guys. Thank you.
Take care, Doris. Bye-bye.